So I was 22, nursing a broken heart, and I knew for sure I had to get out of town. I had just bought my first car. It was a little blue Honda Civic, hoping to break free then from the constraints of the Boulder bus system, robust as I now realize it is. Any of you who have stood in the snow waiting for a bus that's behind schedule and watched person after person from the warmth and safety of their cars pass you by, well, I'm sure you know just what I mean. Owning a car after not having a car is certainly a story of liberation. In any case, the source of my broken heart was multiple. My grandfather, who I had grown up close to, had just died. And my father was wandering around calling himself an orphan with a kind of bitterness profoundly uncharacteristic for the eternal optimist we had all known him as. And none of us knew how to respond. Meanwhile, an intimate relationship I had come to Boulder pursuing was reaching an end as I watched her falling in love with someone new. And then a dear friend back in the Northwest was struggling with depression, and I saw him descending into despair, and I just felt so helpless and stuck. Most of all, I was lonely, just trying to grow up, trying to find my place in the world. Now, up until that point in my life, I had set foot in precisely four other states outside of my home state of Washington, the ones close by: Oregon, California, I had made it over to Hawaii, and my new state of Colorado. And then I'd also been to a bit of Canada that was 17 miles from my hometown. We weren't the kind of family that went on road trips or vacations at all, for that matter. And so when I started to map out where I would go to get out of town, regardless of the direction I took, it was a given that it would put me into unknown, unexplored territory. So I decided I would go visit my best friend, who was at the time studying acting at the Old Globe in San Diego, with a route that would take me across western Colorado, into southern Utah, and then Nevada, through the desert of Southern California. Now, I know it's no backpacking trip around Europe or yoga intensive in India, but for me, the path I set felt radical, terrifying, and liberating. Liberation hit me most fully, in fact, about 6 hours into the journey in southern Utah, just a bit northwest of Moab. Outside my car windows in every direction was terrain I had never even imagined existed. Topography so distant from the rainforest and inland beaches of my growing up, even so different from those flat irons of the Rockies I had more recently discovered. Layers of red rocks, arches, dry desert air, trees and plants, sparse if at all, mostly this grass that swayed in the breeze, and these winding rivers that cut a path through the rock, and the sky so big and luxurious. The beauty so overwhelmed me, I had to pull over. Now, it was before smartphones, so there was no posting to anyone to say, "Hey, look at me," or no connecting immediately with people I knew to say, "I'm here." I felt alone and small, and yet at the same time powerful and capable and profoundly connected to everything and everyone, past, present, and future. The wind hit my hair and everything felt possible. The sun was about to set and its colors went everywhere, and I stood between its light and its shadow, and I could feel my heart starting to regroup. I felt grateful and free. What are your moments in your life of such liberation? What stories do you have where you have felt just released? When have you surrendered yourself deeply and fully to joy? And what did that experience feel like in your body? What do these moments tell us about what it means to be free? Free. Liberated. We use these words so much in our culture and in our religious tradition. But what do we really mean when we describe ourselves, when we describe someone as free? And what are we saying we value when we talk about liberation? And just as importantly, perhaps, what is it that we're being made free from? What are those things that keep us metaphorically or sometimes literally imprisoned? Over this past week, I asked some friends on Facebook to tell me about their moments of liberation, and I got a list of responses. They shared stories of being made free from debt, being released from self-limiting beliefs, freed from fear or from the shoulds of life, freed from pleasing other people. They told me about being liberated from past religious beliefs, from the limbo of experiencing physical symptoms by finally receiving an official diagnosis, from eating disorders, from societal pressures to look or dress a certain way. And for that matter, there was a chorus of voices rejoicing at being liberated at the end of each day from restrictive clothing that many of us wear. Some of you know what I mean more than others. Here in this room, I bet we have a whole list of other things we have been liberated from or wish we could be liberated from. Addiction, depression, rage, unemployment, unhealthy or broken relationships, shame, domestic violence, prejudice, both personal and systemic, fear, past trauma, ignorance, pride or self-doubt, selfishness or selflessness, poverty, perfectionism. The list could go on and on and on. For many of us, discovering Unitarian Universalism at all could be described as a moment of liberation. Made free from ill-fitting dogmatic and creedal requirements, we arrive in this covenantal faith and savor every moment of that free and responsible search for truth and meaning, affirmed by our fourth principle. In my story, standing there on the edge of a red rock canyon and beneath the limitless sky, I felt myself becoming free from bitterness, released from disappointment, liberated from grief. These all are the prisons of our spirits, the prisons of our lives, and the spiritual path invites us along a lifelong journey of liberation, to be made free from all those things which would separate us from our truest selves, from one another, and from the great spirit of life which connects us all. Now, I say lifelong for two main reasons. First, because many things, it turns out, are not easily overcome. Sometimes they take whole lifetimes, and even then, that is not always enough. Some prisons will go to our grave attempting to escape, and then still leave them behind for others to take on our behalf. We inherit our dreams from our ancestors, and we inherit their burdens, their shackles they could not find a way out of. And this path is lifelong, secondly, because new things arrive to block the way to freedom as we walk this path of life. You get one prison behind you, and it never fails. A new one appears. So our job, then, as a religious community, is to help each other discover these oppressive things, to help each other name them as forces keeping us from experiencing freedom, and then to help each other create and then actually follow a path of liberation. We are, in so many ways, each other's saviors. But let's step back for a moment. Now, I just said this was the work of a lifetime. I said that sometimes we don't even know when we are enslaved, that we need help to see oppressive forces around us, and that sometimes you can try all your life and still not be free. Now, given all this, you have to wonder, why is it that anyone would take on such a task? What makes liberation a worthy pursuit? What makes freedom matter? Or to say it another way, regardless of what we are being made free from, what are we being made free for? Now, although we could come up with a long list of things, I just listed a bunch of them, that we could imagine things we are being made free from, in our culture, we often boil down our answer to what we are freed for to something pretty singular. That is, individual self-determination. We are free for personal, individualized choice. As religious scholar Lou Anne Trost says in her article, Rethinking Freedom, these unified notions of freedom have been shaped by the Enlightenment, which reduced freedom to mean the capacity for self-direction. She says, the culturally popular notion of freedom is the idea of an autonomous self having the space to make decisions or choices. The freer you are relates directly to how much you are able to act according to your own will, your own desires. That, I believe, was the kind of freedom that all those sonic booms and blinding blasts were about a few days ago, celebrating the moment nearly 250 years ago when we were made free, which is to say, independent. Many of our stories of liberation are told in this way. Individuals who have been restricted from being themselves, from acting according to their own free will, are liberated into self-determination. The civil rights movement is often told as a story of self-determination, and queer liberation too. Individuals are freed from being told how to be and think and feel, and then individuals are freed for acting, thinking, and feeling for themselves. And yet, if liberation is only a matter of allowing each of us to act according to our own individualized will, only to enable greater personal choice, then taken to the ultimate expression, well, imagine it. How isolated we would need to be so free. How lonely such a world would be. And how unsustainable such a world would be. Now, when I go back into my own story in southern Utah, I know that a component of the freedom I experienced related with a sense of personal choice has something to do with that blue Honda Civic, I think. But that was a small part of what I was really made free for. More than that, I was made free for personal relationships, for new relationships, for new love. I was released from my past and liberated into a new future. And that future was not free because I was independent, but because I could openly, that's freely, receive it as it unfolded before me. Returning to our scholar for a moment, Trost goes on in her article to argue that we'd be better served to add to our enlightenment-based understanding of freedom by considering freedom also as related to our capacity to continue, to have a free future, to flourish, to freely engage that future. Liberation then becomes not just about individual choice, but about creative capacity, about resilience, and about depth of resources. Which is to say, liberation is less about any one of us individually and more about who we are together. Let's bring this back to real life, shall we? to our own stories of liberation, those moments when we have felt free. Maybe those things in your lives right now where you'd like to be freed from. I'm going to give us just 30 seconds or so for you to really think about those things, past or present, experiences or maybe desires for liberation. And as you let them come into your mind in the next 30 seconds, consider what it is that you are being made free for. You have 30 seconds. No small task. All right. Any brave souls willing to just name just a word or a phrase that you're being made free for? Just call it out.
Be a better parent. Help others.
Very good. You're. There's many things we are made free for, and I would guess that all of us have some element of individual autonomy mixed in with our answers. But I would also guess that we also have some notion of a relationship or commitment in our response as well. So returning to those stories I collected, friends shared that they were made free for, this is just a few, living according to their commitments and values, liberated into a greater intimacy with friends, in a shared vulnerability, released into a deeper love for the world in all its challenge and possibility. It is perhaps a great irony that we are liberated so that we can then tie ourselves down more fully into our most deeply held commitments. While we release ourselves from one kind of prison, if we wish to surrender more deeply into freedom and joy, we must bind ourselves up in other ways. Bind ourselves in relationship, bind ourselves to our values, bind ourselves to a people, a hope, and a vision of the world and its future that we give ourselves in partnership to create. The paradox of liberation as both personal autonomy and deepened commitments rests behind those words that are inscribed on my ordination stole. They're offered by the Jewish theologian Martin Buber, whose oft-quoted assessment of human beings is that we are promise-making, promise-breaking, and promise-renewing creatures. Human life, it is to say, is given its fullest expression in the tension between our need to satisfy our individual self-expression and the acknowledgement that we are meant to be free for something more than just ourselves. And we often describe Unitarian Universalism as a free faith, which we usually take as an indicator of our personal autonomy. Understanding liberation as both personal autonomy and future flourishing allows us to better integrate that we are not simply a free faith, but also a covenantal faith. The word covenant means coming together or bind. In its most sacred meaning, its intent is to bind people in relationship across lifetimes, come what may. We all experience covenantal relationships, whether or not we are Unitarian Universalists. We are in covenant with our children, with our spouses, with our closest friends. Some of us even say that they are in covenant with all of creation. Unless we idealize or romanticize such relationship, let's be clear that they often feel the exact opposite of freedom. The phrase ball and chain to describe someone's spouse was invented to signify just how unfreeing covenants might feel in real life. And yet, in our faith, as in our personal relationships of covenant, we choose to restrict our individual autonomy because we affirm a different sort of freedom, a freedom that allows us all to flourish, a freedom that fosters our mutual future, a freedom that means fulfilling our most deeply held commitments, our sacred promises, in partnership with others. A freedom that is about all of us surrendering to joy together. This is the hope of liberation in our faith and in our lives, as in the world. Let us faithfully fulfill the promise of freedom together. Blessed be, and amen.